lava food every day. Although there's no statistic difference, this one is a little bit high. It gets 80% survival, and those are the sample sizes we have, 96 lava and 96 lava. The error bar represents, we use 24 lava as a replicate, so in other words, this will be three different replicates and just use the mortality average over the three replicates. And an error. And then we tested different feeding regions, trying to vary the amount of food the larva are receiving. So in dose one, we give them the same amount of diet, 100 microliters per day. And in another one, we reduce the amount in the second and third day. Sometimes when you are dealing with SBTI, soybean trypsin inhibitor, they are very expensive, so you want to use the minimum amount of diet that's possible to maintain the same survival. But this seems not working. When you try to reduce the diet, the mortality goes down. So you got 60% survival here in the number three, and then in the standard one, we have about 70% survival. Significant difference. In trying to improve that 75-80% survival to even more, we thought maybe the wax plates are not ideal, so the plastic plates are not ideal, so we thought about coating with beeswax in those plates, thinking the natural environment of bees actually in the waxy cells, but contrary to our expectation, the beeswax coated plates actually did much worse. Larva just easily get stuck in those cells because the wax are very sticky, and so we have nearly 80% survival in the non-coated, but below 60% in the wax coated. So based on those parameters, we standardized our assay. So because larva transfer did not improve survival, we did not do any transfer in the future experiments. Antibiotics and vitamin C did not improve survival either, so we did not add this, so because that's more variables. We actually used the region, used this one in 200 and 200 microliters later in the last 3 days, in this year in 207, but there's no difference really between the 100 all the way. But I guess my student thought this would be better. And wax coating reduced survival, so we decided not to do any coating. So we further used this test to see if it would be able to detect any differences for effects of the chemicals in the market, such as E64, and we know that STBI, the soybean trypsin inhibitor, has been published and it has a negative effect on honeybees, so we use that as a positive control to detect any effect. E64, it has this structure, the chemical structure here. It has been tested. I think the next talk will probably talk on this chemical, the effect of it on the plant bug. But the effect of this chemical on honeybees has not been studied. So we used five different treatments. We used BSA as a negative control, it's 2%, and then E64 we used J.J. Duan's publication as a reference, used a very low dose, 0.6% as a high dose, and then 10 times less for the low dose. And STBI, we used 2% as a high dose and then 1% as a low dose. We did not use a blank control, but we know that in the literature that BSA in larva diet at 2%, which is 2% of the total protein, not of the total diet weight, did not have any adverse effect. But we went ahead and tested anyway in our system to see, to make sure there's no difference in terms of time to the development to the adults and the emergence weight and the mortality. So here 31 survived and 29 survived out of 48 larva. So there's no significant difference in all the parameters we measured. So this is the data on the effect of E64 on larva and pupal survival, which is a total survival, in other words, from first day larva to adults. The SA has about 82% survival, which is very good, and SDBI high, 50% survival, significantly different. This is very similar to Malone reported. She found that 25% the reduction was 2% SBTI, but the control had 50% survival only. So actually, our assay here is a little bit more sensitive. We have 30% reduction, 32% reduction, because probably mainly because our control here has a high survival. And SDBI, low dose at 1%, we still detected a significant difference in reduction of survival. And E64, low and high, those are, the effect seems to be lower than SBTI, high dose, but it is significantly different from the control. Moving to weight of newly emerged workers, this is the one, another parameter we could measure. Even if the bees survive, they could be malnutrition, or the sublethal effect have reduced the weight, for example. So we have BSA here has an average weight of 140 milligrams, and SBTI high dose is significantly lower, and the E64 two dose is not significant in this trial. But if we combine, we actually did two trials. Each trial was three different colonies, so we actually have six replicates. If we combine all those, I think we do see a significant difference between the baseline and the E64. Developmental time, we do see SDBI high dose caused about 1 day delay here, but in this particular trial, it's not statistically significant. So in the BSA, we expect a 21-day development time from first day larva to enclosed adults. And sometimes when you have sublethal effects, whether pesticides or BT products, they could delay the development time, which is also not good. But SDBI here, I believe if we pull all the results, we'll see a significant effect here. In this particular trial, it's not significant. So in summary, we have developed a standardized test. By modifying previously published procedures and average survival we have, it's very good. It's 75 to 85% from first instar larva to adults. Well, maybe we just got lucky. We had a good batch of royal jelly from China. My next step is actually testing different commercial sources of royal jelly and to see if I do expect significant variation among the quality of the royal jelly. Of course, the best way is actually use a totally artificial diet, and I think my lab could be on the right track. I was playing while doing this, playing with some liquid diet, and bees survived for about 5 days, and they died only just before pupation. That was nothing, was no royal jelly, no casein, no yeast extract, just totally non-chemical composition, amino acids and stuff. So we plan to test the repeatability of this assay also in different labs during the summer of 2008. So this could be transferred to testing labs in the industry. And finally, E64 showed a weak effect on honeybee survival, on developmental time, and adult emergence weight, but they're not as strong as SBTI. This is probably congruent with previous study. Of course, it's hard to compare because the SDBI we used 2% and the E64 we use 0.06%, so it's difficult to do a direct comparison between those two chemicals. I'd like to thank the ABSTC for funding this research, and Jian Duang for input in experimental design, and constantly prodding me doing more trials, and a statistical analysis. Thank you. I think you have time for questions.
No?
Given, until the time when we can have an artificial diet, and given the differences in royal jelly that you've seen, can you develop like a pre-screen to check the...
Yeah, that's what I intend to do. Yeah, that's. I already know a reliable source in China. I have used this one for 2 or 3 years, and they're very consistent. So even... But I also want to test just to see what else are out there. And I do know one European study used raw jelly in Michigan, actually, and then they had 20% survival in the control. So, and I think that paper will have trouble being published just because you have so little power to detect anything with such a high mortality in the control. The question is, there are already standardized inputting proteins or pollens into larval cells and then returning the brood into the colony, and that seems to be very consistent. And why bother with the lab assay? As I mentioned in the introduction, the lab assay just have more control, and I think it's more believable. We don't really know. For example, there are so many unknowns. We don't know if nurses could remove proteins. I think there's no studies actually verified. If you put 100 microliter BT protein, how much do you recover from the larva? How much is eaten by the larva? Versus nurse is very sensitive. You know, I studied bees in my PhD, and we tried to add hexane extracts in different larvae. They get all eaten. As soon as you smell something, you touch a larva with a brush, they get eaten next day. So you add in exotic substance into the hive, we don't know how much, maybe they are all eaten by the larva, not consumed by nurses. But this is a question, it's a potential effect. So if you use this totally lab approach, then you're removing those possible artifacts. So.
What is the difference of your method to the open air method?
What's my difference to the other one? To the European method, okay, European method. It's very complicated. They use some dental gel or something on the bottom, and they want to weigh the larva. But I couldn't replicate the assay in my lab, and I think other labs in the U.S. has tried to replicate it, cannot replicate it. I had probably 50% survival using that assay. The amount of larva food they put is simply not enough. They used 50 microliters, for example, per day, whereas we tested even 75 microliters per day. In the last 3 days, you have high mortality, and I think the assay is too complicated, and it's difficult to replicate. Yeah. I didn't understand your question. If the nurses are removing the food from the larva, then...
Yeah.
No. I think people have studied BT pollen feeding to the whole colony or feeding to the bees. Of course, the larva actually do not receive a lot of pollen directly. They're eating royal jelly protein, which is secreted by the hypopharyngeal gland secretion and mixed with mandibular gland secretion. So the nurses are actually consuming, digesting the pollen and then producing protein to the larva. But the answer to your question is no, nobody has. We don't know. That's just the potential, as I said, potential to cause artifact. It could also be product dependent. So you could use E64, maybe the nurses do not remove it. And you use quiet protein, maybe nurses are sensitive and remove it. So then you'll be product dependent. So that's why it's better to have a total lab assay. I mean, I also published a study using the same assay she mentioned, using feeding larva directly, which is easier. So, but I still think this would be more, be better, more reliable. So, just my opinion.
Against first instars of Colorado potato beetle, showing that bioactivity had been retained. And from these studies, we were able to infer that intact bioactive protein was present at the nominal concentration in that meat diet. Here's the Western. Lanes 1 and 2 are a positive control, and 3 and 4 are the extract from the diet, showing very nicely that it's not degraded and it's the right molecular weight. These are the bioassay data. Lanes five and six is a positive control added to the Colorado potato beetle diet, and three and four are the diet extracts added to their diet, and you can see that there's comparable bioactivity there. And the recovery of this protein varied among diets. In aureus, we were able to get nearly 96%, Aliocara 92%, very good recovery. In the Bacillus diet, there was 24%, probably showing degradation of the protein in the pupae. In the dipped aphids, we were able to get nearly 20% of the concentration in the dipping solution. And then these numbers then go into the risk assessment. Now, I should say the recovery may not be the only factor when you determine your exposure. For example, in an earthworm study, we dosed the soil with the test substance, and we were only able to get 18% of the nominal concentration of protein out of the soil immediately after treatment. However, at the end of the study, 14 days, there was still 7.6% of the protein in there, and there was bioactivity. And this suggested that it wasn't degradation that was preventing us recovering the nominal amount of concentration of protein at the beginning of the study. It was simply that it's very difficult to extract the protein from soil. So think about it when you get an ELISA reading that shows something that, you know, is perhaps unexpected. So finally, just to summarise, these microbial test substances are very useful for hazard testing because they can deliver high doses or concentrations. They can simplify interpretation of effects that you see in a study. You need care, need to be careful to ensure that they're equivalent to the plant protein, and as I've showed, there are various methods for doing that. One thing I didn't mention was that I think it's advisable to periodically recharacterise your test substance. That they can lose bioactivity, for example, in storage. And the other thing is that a suitable artificial diet is essential to maintain development of bioactivity, and you also need to demonstrate exposure in the study to have a convincing study. Thanks very much.
I'm just going to go over some basics about springtails and earthworm testing for the modifications that were made to some of the chemical tests already in place for genetically modified crops. And this is where I'm located, Springborn Smithers Laboratory in Wareham, Mass. This has already been covered pretty well in the previous talks, but just for those of you that might have just stepped in, just a very basic history. Genetically engineered crops have been widespread use since the 80s, regulated under FIFRA and the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. The white paper, which has already been discussed, was put out in 2007 as sort of a beginning step as a guideline for how to handle some of these plant-incorporated proteins. Two common soil inhabitants used in environmental testing currently are springtails and earthworms. For a quick background of them, this is Folsomia candida, one of the common springtails that is used in these tests. They're pretty small. They're about 5 millimeters in length, parthenogenic, fairly happy little things jumping around, feeding on fungus, common soil inhabitants. One of the probably beneficial things about them is that they're fairly good representation of an insect because they're in a wide variety of habitats: soil, leaf litter, surface of ponds, fungus, even snow in some cases, the different species. So they make a good representative. Isania fetida, one of the red worms, is another common inhabitant of the soil. You can't really dig too many holes somewhere without running across some earthworms, so they're fairly common. It's something that is most likely going to encounter some of these proteins. Here is just an example of their cocoons that they produce, and this particular species will produce on average about 3 organisms from each cocoon. And this is sort of a size difference between them. The cocoon is, I guess I can use this, the cocoon is right here, sort of a size comparison for the earthworm. For chemical testing, there's typically a 100-fold limit, and for the soil tests. It's 1,000 milligrams per kilogram testing limit, which can serve as the limit of the test. A lot of times the range that the LD50s or some of these other values you're trying to find, you don't have any historical data to suggest what the definitive range should be. So you would have sort of this range finding test just so you could identify what range you're talking about to close in on that number as best as you can. The two common tests in the guidelines, there's a 14-day earthworm acute test, which the endpoints is mortality, although we do record observations like lethargic behaviors, segmentation, and we also record the weights of the earthworms as well. But mortality in this case is the primary endpoint. For springtail chronic testing, it's a 28-day study, you can go through the entire reproductive cycle, and you're measuring mortality again and offspring per adult. For chemical testing, the product is typically added, if it's water soluble, into the water first and then into the mixtures. If it's not, you'll need to deliver it with something else like acetone or some other volatile that you can evaporate it off. You remove a portion of the sand from the mix and evaporate that under a hood so it's mixed in with the sand before you mix it in with the complete soil mixture. And then there's also spraying the surface, which kind of mimics sort of a field application. Here's just an example of the test system, which is just a 1-liter beaker. Approximately 600 grams of soil, artificial soil, is placed in this, and about 10 earthworms, not about, exactly 10 earthworms, at 2 to 12 months of age. For chemical testing, we found that we've also mixed it in directly with the food instead of mixing it with soil, and there's certain advantages to that. We use the same plaster charcoal mix that's used in the culture, so there's no sort of acclimation issues that you have to worry about. It's also easier to clean the fungus that can develop from the food that you're feeding them, and keep track of the health during the exposure. It's a 28-day exposure, and sometimes it's nice to be able to weekly observe these organisms under a microscope to find out how you're progressing. In case it got too dry in there and maybe they all died after the first week, you're not waiting an additional 3 weeks to just restart the test. So it's kind of nice that if you take some time under a dissecting scope, you can really monitor the health and egg laying and any other issues that might crop up. Because with the soil system, they're kind of hard to see. There's cracks and crevices, and they are small insects that can kind of blend in. And it can be hard to keep track of them. So that type of test system looks like this. It's they're 4-ounce jars, approximately 1 centimeter deep of the substrate, which is again a plastered charcoal mixture. 10 organisms each are placed into each vessel, and they're about 10 to 12 days old. It takes about 3 weeks to generate the test organism because it'll take about 10 days for the eggs to hatch, and then you have to wait 10 to 12 days after that, approximately. Some of the considerations for testing would be that chemicals can be packaged in a concentration that might need to be diluted for a field application. And so for sort of a worst case, I can certainly imagine some end user not following the label instructions and receiving some sort of dose that he's not supposed to be, and worker exposure. And so I can certainly see why they might have these test exposure requirements of testing for 100-fold to cover some of these atypical exposures, sort of a worst case but a reasonable one. As a quick background, most of the proteins that are incorporated in these plants are all BT-derived proteins. They're fairly specific. They work under a fairly specific pH range. Most animals have an acidic midgut, and the ranges that these work at are neutral to more of a basic level, and they're and most of the species have this narrow band of pH ranges in their midgut, so that's why they tend to be a little bit more species or family specific. It's just something that tends to happen. It's not a generality, and then it effectively just causes starvation due to killed midgut cells. The BT genes are considered by the EPA to be a reduced risk pesticide, and which would explain why they typically see like a tenfold testing limit for these to serve as a limit test, as opposed to the hundredfold in chemical testing. Range finding exposures are also not necessary due to the fact that they're not expecting to see any results in some of these non-target organisms. What's already been covered in some other talks is the fact that there's the use of two different